Section 3, The Asian World. Voices from the Past. The Mongols were masters of military tactics. John of Plano Carpini, a Franciscan friar, wrote, "As soon as they discover the enemy, they charge, and each one unleashes 3 or 4 arrows. If they see that they can't break him, they retreat in order to entice the enemy to pursue, thus luring him into an ambush prepared in advance. If they conclude that the enemy army is stronger, they retire for a day or two and ravage neighboring areas, or they set up camp in a well-chosen position, and when the enemy army begins to pass by, they appear unexpectedly." L'Empire des Steppes, René Grousset, 1939. Due in large part to their military prowess, the Mongols rose to power in Asia with stunning speed. China reunified. The Han Dynasty came to an end in 220, and China fell into chaos. For the next 300 years, the Chinese suffered through disorder and civil war. Then, in 581, a new Chinese empire was set up under a dynasty known as the Sui. The Sui Dynasty, 581 to 618, did not last long, but it managed to unify China once again under the emperor's authority. The Tang Dynasty. A new dynasty, the Tang, soon emerged. It would last for almost 300 years, from 618 until 907. The early Tang rulers began their reigns by instituting reforms, as rulers often did in the early days of new dynasties. They restored the civil service examination started by the Qin dynasty to serve as the chief method of recruiting officials for the civilian bureaucracy. They also tried to create a more stable economy by giving land to the peasants and breaking up the power of large landowners. Tang rulers worked hard to restore the power of China in East Asia. They brought peace to northwestern China and expanded China's control into the area north of the Himalaya, known as Tibet. China claimed to be the greatest power in East Asia. The end of the Tang Dynasty came in the early 10th century at the hands of the Uyghurs, a northern tribal group of Turkic-speaking people. The Uyghurs had been hired to fight for the Tang Dynasty. Instead, they overthrew the Tang ruler in 907. China again slipped into civil war. The Sung Dynasty. In 960, a new dynasty known as the Sung rose to power. The Sung ruled during a period of economic prosperity and cultural achievement from 960 to 1279. From the start, however, the Sung also experienced problems, especially from the Uyghurs in northern China. The Sung also lost control over Tibet. The Sung dynasty could never overcome the challenge from the north. During the 1200s, the Mongols, a nomadic people from the Gobi, carried out wars of conquest and built a vast empire. Within 70 years, they controlled all of China. The Mongols overthrew the Sung and created a new Mongol dynasty. Government, economy, and society. The era from the beginning of the Sui dynasty to the end of the Sung dynasty lasted nearly 700 years. During that period, a mature political system based on principles first put into practice during the Qin and Han dynasties gradually emerged in China. As in the Han era, China was a monarchy that employed a relatively large bureaucracy. Beyond the capital, government was centered around provinces, districts, and villages. Confucian ideals were the cement that held the system together. During the long period between the Sui and Sung dynasties, the Chinese economy grew in size and complexity. Agriculture flourished, and manufacturing and trade grew dramatically. In Chinese cities, technological developments added new products and stimulated trade. During the Tang Dynasty, for example, the Chinese began to make steel for swords and sickles and invented gunpowder, used for explosives, and a flamethrower called a fire lance. Long-distance trade had declined between the 4th and 6th centuries as a result of the collapse of both the Han Dynasty and the Roman Empire. Trade revived under the Tang Dynasty, in part because of the unification of much of Southwest Asia under the Arabs. The Silk Road was renewed and thrived as caravans carried goods between China and the countries of Southwest and South Asia. Economic changes had an impact on Chinese society. For wealthier city dwellers, the Tang and Sung eras were times of prosperity. The Sung capital of Hangzhou, for example, flourished. In the late 13th century, the Italian merchant Marco Polo described the city to European readers as one of the largest and wealthiest cities on earth. "So many pleasures may be found," he said, "that one fancies himself to be in paradise." The vast majority of the Chinese people still lived off the land in villages. Most peasants never left their villages except for an occasional visit to a nearby market town. Changes were taking place in the countryside, however. Before, there had been a great gulf between wealthy landowners and poor peasants. A more complex mixture of landowners, free peasants, sharecroppers, and landless laborers now emerged. Reading check. Describing. Identify one of the broad goals of the Tang dynasty and describe how Tang rulers worked to reach it. The Mongol Empire. The Mongols were a pastoral people from the region of modern-day Mongolia who were organized loosely into clans. Temujin, born during the 1160s, gradually unified the Mongols. In 1206, he was elected Genghis Khan, or strong ruler, at a massive meeting somewhere in the Gobi. From that time on, he devoted himself to conquest. The Mongols brought much of the Eurasian landmass under a single rule, creating the largest land empire in history. To rule the new Mongol Empire, Genghis Khan set up a capital city at Karakorum. Mongol armies traveled both to the west and to the east. Some went as far as Central Europe. After the death of Genghis Khan in 1227, the empire began to change. Following Mongol custom, upon the death of the ruling Khan, his heirs divided the territory. The once united empire of Genghis Khan was thus split into several separate territories called Khanates, each under the rule of one of his sons. In 1231, the Mongols attacked Persia and then defeated the Abbasids at Baghdad in 1258. In the 1260s, a new wave of invasion began when Mongol forces attacked the Sung in China. In their attack on the Chinese, the Mongols encountered the use of gunpowder and the fire lance. By the early 14th century, foreigners employed by the Mongol rulers of China had introduced gunpowder and firearms into Europe. The Mongol Dynasty in China. In 1279, one of Genghis Khan's grandsons, named Kublai Khan, completed the conquest of the Sung and established a new Chinese dynasty, the Yuan. Kublai Khan, who ruled China until his death in 1294, established his capital at Khanbalik, the city of the Khan, in northern China. Later, the city would be known by the Chinese name Beijing. Under the leadership of the talented Kublai Khan, the Yuan or Mongol dynasty continued to expand the empire. Mongol armies advanced into Vietnam, and Mongol fleets were launched against Java and Sumatra, and twice against the islands of Japan. Only Vietnam was conquered, however, and then only for a while. The Mongols had more success in ruling China. Mongol rulers adapted to the Chinese political system. Over time, the Mongols won the support of many Chinese people. Some came to respect the stability and economic prosperity that the Mongols at first brought to China. The capital at Khanbalik reflected Mongol prosperity. It was a magnificent city, and foreign visitors were impressed by its splendor. The Mongol dynasty eventually fell victim to the same problems that had plagued other dynasties. In 1368, Zhu Yuanzhang, the son of a peasant, raised an army, ended the Mongol dynasty, and set up a new dynasty, the Ming dynasty. Religion. By the time the Mongols established their dynasty in China, religious preferences in the Chinese court had undergone a number of changes. Confucian principles became the basis for Chinese government during the Han dynasty, 202 BC to AD 220. By the time of the Sui and Tang dynasties, Buddhism and Taoism rivaled the influence of Confucianism. During the last half of the Tang dynasty, however, Confucianism became dominant at court, a position it retained until the early 20th century. A golden age in art and literature. The period between the Tang and Ming dynasties was in many ways the great age of Chinese art and literature. During the Sung and Mongol dynasties, landscape painting reached its high point. Influenced by Taoism, Chinese artists went into the mountains to paint and find the Tao, or way, in nature. This practice explains in part the emphasis on nature in traditional Chinese painting. The word for landscape in Chinese means mountain water and reflects the Taoist search for balance between the earth and water. Chinese artists tried to reveal the hidden forms of the landscape. Rather than depicting the realistic shape of a specific mountain, for example, they tried to portray the idea of mountain. Empty spaces were left in the paintings because Taoists believe one cannot know the whole truth. The invention of printing during the Tang dynasty helped to make literature more readily available and more popular. It was in poetry, above all, that the Chinese of this time best expressed their literary talents. Chinese poems celebrated the beauty of nature, the changes of the seasons, and the joys of friendship. They expressed sadness at the shortness of life and the necessity of parting. Li Bua was one of the most popular poets during the Tang era. Li Bua was a free spirit whose writing often centered on nature. The following is probably the best-known poem in China and has been memorized by schoolchildren for centuries. It is entitled Quiet Night Thoughts. Beside my bed, the bright moonbeams bound almost as if there were frost on the ground. Raising up, I gaze at the mountain moon. Lying back, I think of my old hometown. Reading check. Summarizing. What invention helped make literature both more available and more popular? The rise of the Japanese state. Chinese and Japanese societies have historically been very different. One of the reasons for these differences is geography. Whereas China is on a vast continent, Japan is a chain of many islands. The population is concentrated on four main islands, Hokkaido, the main island of Honshu, and the two smaller islands of Kyushu and Shikoku. Japan's total land area is approximately 146,000 square miles, or 378,000 square kilometers, about the size of the state of Montana. In the early 7th century, Shotoku Taishi, a prince of the Yamato clan, tried to unify the various Japanese clans in order to more effectively resist an invasion by the Chinese. He began to create a new centralized system of government in Japan, based roughly on the structure of the Chinese government. Prince Shotoku wanted a centralized government under a supreme ruler. His objective was to limit the powers of the small class of aristocrats and enhance the Yamato ruler's, his own, authority. As a result, the ruler was portrayed as a divine figure and the symbol of the Japanese nation. The Nara period. After Shotoku Taishi's death in 622, political power fell into the hands of the Fujiwara clan. A Yamato ruler was still emperor, but he was strongly influenced by the Fujiwara family. In 710, a new capital was established at Nara. The emperor began to use the title Son of Heaven. Though the reforms begun by Prince Shotoku continued during this period, Japan's central government could not overcome the power of the aristocrats. These powerful families were able to keep the taxes from the lands for themselves. Unable to gain tax revenues, the central government steadily lost power and influence. The Heian period. In 794, the emperor moved the capital from Nara to nearby Heian, on the site of present-day Kyoto. At Heian, the emperor continued to rule in name, but actual power remained in the hands of the Fujiwara clan. In fact, the government was returning to the decentralized system that had existed before the time of Shotoku Taishi. Powerful families, whose wealth was based on the ownership of tax-exempt farmland, dominated the rural areas. With the decline of central power, local aristocrats tended to take justice into their own hands. They turned increasingly to military force as a means of protecting their interests. A new class of military servants emerged, whose purpose was to protect the security and property of their employers. Called the samurai, or those who serve, these warriors resembled the knights of medieval Europe. Like knights, the samurai fought on horseback, clad in helmet and armor, although a samurai carried a sword and a bow and arrow rather than a lance and shield. Like knights, the samurai were supposed to live by a strict warrior code known in Japan as Bushido, or the way of the warrior. Above all, the samurai's code was based on loyalty to his lord. The Kamakura Shogunate. By the end of the 12th century, rivalries among Japanese aristocratic families had led to almost constant civil war. Finally, a powerful noble named Minamoto Yoritomo defeated several rivals and set up his power near the modern city of Tokyo. To strengthen the state, he created a more centralized government under a powerful military leader known as the shogun, or general. In this new system, called the shogunate, the emperor remained ruler in name only and the shogun exercised the actual power. The Kamakura shogunate, founded by Yoritomo, lasted from 1192 to 1333. At first, the system worked well. The Japanese were fortunate that it did, because the government soon faced its most serious challenge yet from the Mongols. In 1281, Kublai Khan sent nearly 150,000 warriors to invade Japan. Fortunately for the Japanese, most of the Mongol ships were destroyed by a typhoon or violent storm before the forces could land. Japan would not again face a foreign invader until American troops landed in the summer of 1945. Fighting the Mongols put a heavy strain on the political system. In 1333, the Kamakura shogunate was overthrown by a group of powerful families led by the Ashikaga family. The power of the local aristocrats grew during the 14th and 15th centuries. Heads of noble families, now called daimyo, great names, controlled vast landed estates that owed no taxes to the government. By 1500, Japan was close to chaos, a disastrous civil war which lasted from 1467 to 1477 led to the virtual destruction of the capital city of Kyoto. Armies passed back and forth through the city, burning temples and palaces. Central authority disappeared. Reading check. Describing: what difficulties did Japanese rulers encounter in establishing a strong central government? Life and culture in early Japan. Early Japan was mostly a farming society. Its people took advantage of the limited amount of farmland and abundant rainfall to grow wet rice, or rice grown in flooded fields. As we have seen, noble families were able to maintain control over most of the land. Trade and manufacturing began to develop during the Kamakura period. Markets appeared in the larger towns, and industries such as paper, iron casting, and porcelain emerged. Trade between regions also grew. Foreign trade, mainly with Korea and China, began during the 11th century. Japan shipped raw materials, paintings, swords, and other manufactured items in return for silk, porcelain, books, and copper coins. Early Japanese people worshipped spirits called kami, whom the Japanese believed resided in trees, rivers, streams, and mountains. The Japanese also believed that the spirits of their ancestors were present in the air around them. In Japan, these beliefs evolved into a kind of state religion called Shinto, the sacred way, or the way of the gods, which is still practiced today. In Japanese art and architecture, landscape serves as an important means of expression. The landscape surrounding the 14th century Golden Pavilion in Kyoto displays a harmony of garden, water, and architecture that makes it one of the treasures of the world. Reading check. Identifying: what industries emerged in Japan during the Kamakura period? India after the Guptas. In the early 8th century, Islam became popular in the northwestern corner of the Indian subcontinent. The new religion had a major impact on Indian civilization. This impact is still evident today in the division of the Indian subcontinent into mostly Hindu India and the two Islamic states of Bangladesh and Pakistan. One reason for Islam's success in South Asia is that it arrived at a time when India was in a state of great political disunity. The Gupta Empire had collapsed, and no central authority had replaced it. India was divided into about 70 states, which fought each other constantly. When the Arab armies reached India in the early 8th century, they did little more than move into the frontier regions. At the end of the 10th century, however, a new phase of Islamic expansion took place when rebellious Turkish slaves founded a new Islamic state known as Ghazni, located in present-day Afghanistan. When the founder of the new state died in 997, his son, Mahmud of Ghazni, succeeded him. Mahmud, an ambitious man, began to attack neighboring Hindu kingdoms to the southeast. Before his death in 1030, he was able to extend his rule throughout the upper Indus Valley and as far south as the Indian Ocean. Resistance against the advances of Mahmud and his successors into northern India was led by the Rajputs, who were Hindu warriors. They fought bravely, but their military tactics, based on infantry supported by elephants, were no match for the cavalry of the invaders. Mahmud's successors continued their advances. By 1200, Muslim power had reached over the entire plain of northern India, creating a new Muslim state known as the Sultanate of Delhi. In the 14th century, this state extended its power into the Deccan Plateau. The impact of Timur Lenk. During the latter half of the 14th century, the Sultanate of Delhi began to decline. Near the end of the century, a new military force crossed the Indus River from the northwest, raided the capital of Delhi, and then withdrew. As many as 100,000 Hindu prisoners were massacred before the gates of the city. It was India's first meeting with Timur Lenk, or Tamerlane. Timur Lenk was the ruler of a Mongol state based in Samarkand, to the north of the Pamir Mountains. Born sometime during the 1330s in Samarkand, Timur Lenk seized power in 1369 and immediately launched a program of conquest. During the 1380s, he placed the entire region east of the Caspian Sea under his authority, and then occupied Mesopotamia. After his brief foray into northern India, he turned to the west. He died in 1405 in the midst of a military campaign. The death of Timur-Lenk removed a menace from the various states of the Indian subcontinent, but the calm did not last long. By the early 16th century, two new challenges had appeared from beyond the horizon. One came from the north in the form of the Mughals, a newly emerging nomadic power. The other came from Europe, from Portuguese traders arriving by sea in search of gold and spices. Islam and Indian society. The Muslim rulers in India viewed themselves as foreign conquerors. As a result, they maintained a strict separation between the Muslim ruling class and the mass of the Hindu population. Many Muslim rulers in India were tolerant of other faiths. They used peaceful means, if any, to encourage people to convert to Islam. Most Muslim rulers realized that there were simply too many Hindus to convert them all. They accepted the need to tolerate what to them was an alien religion. Nevertheless, Muslim rulers did impose many Islamic customs on Hindu society. Overall, the relationship between Muslim and Hindu was that of conqueror and conquered, a relationship marked by suspicion and dislike rather than friendship and understanding. Reading check. Evaluating. What was the relationship between the Muslims and Hindus in India? Civilization in Southeast Asia. Between China and India lies the region that today is called Southeast Asia. It has two major ports. One is the mainland region, extending southward from the Chinese border down to the tip of the Malay Peninsula. The other is an extensive archipelago, or chain of islands, most of which is part of present-day Indonesia and the Philippines. Located between India and China, two highly advanced and densely populated regions of the world, Southeast Asia is a melting pot of peoples. The formation of states. Between 500 and 1500, a number of organized states developed throughout Southeast Asia. When the peoples of the region began to form states, they used models from China and India. At the same time, they adapted these models to their own needs and created their own unique states. The Chinese conquered Vietnam in 111 BC, but the Vietnamese overthrew Chinese rule in the 10th century. Chinese influence remained, though. Vietnamese rulers followed the Chinese model of centralized government, calling themselves emperors and practicing Chinese court rituals. The new Vietnamese state, which called itself Đại Việt, or Great Viet, also adopted state Confucianism. In the 9th century, the kingdom of Angkor arose in the region that is present-day Cambodia. A powerful figure named Jayavarman united the Khmer people and established a capital at Angkor Thom. For several hundred years, Angkor, or the Khmer Empire, was the most powerful state in mainland Southeast Asia. In 1432, the Thai from the north destroyed the Angkor capital. They set up their own capital at Ayutthaya on the Chao Phraya River, where they remained as a major force for the next 400 years. The Thai were threatened from the west by the Burman peoples, who had formed their own society in the valleys of the Salween and Irrawaddy rivers. In the 11th century, they founded the first great Burman state, the Kingdom of Pagan. Like the Thai, they adopted Indian political institutions and culture. In the Malay Peninsula and the Indonesian archipelago, a different pattern emerged. For centuries, this area had been tied to the trade that passed from East Asia into the Indian Ocean. The area had never been united under a single state, however. The vast majority of the people of the region were of Malay background, but the peoples were divided into numerous separate communities. Society and culture. At the top of the social ladder in most Southeast Asian societies were the hereditary aristocrats. They held both political power and economic wealth. Most aristocrats lived in the major cities. Angkor Thom, for example, was a city with royal palaces, parks, and numerous temples. Beyond the major cities lived the rest of the population, which consisted of farmers, fishers, artisans, and merchants. In most Southeast Asian societies, the majority of people were probably rice farmers who lived at a bare level of subsistence and paid heavy rents or taxes to a landlord or local ruler. Chinese culture made an impact on Vietnam. In many other areas of Southeast Asia, Indian cultural influence prevailed. The most visible example of this influence was in architecture. Of all the existing structures at Angkor Thom, the Temple of Angkor Wat is the most famous and most beautiful. It combines Indian architectural techniques with native inspiration in a structure of impressive grace. The construction of Angkor Wat, which took 40 years to complete, required an enormous quantity of stone, as much as it took to build Egypt's Great Pyramid. Reading check. Contrasting. How did the development of the Malay Peninsula and the Indonesian archipelago differ from development elsewhere in Southeast Asia? National Geographic. Special report. Lord of the Mongols. Genghis Khan. Samarkand, Bukhara, Urgenchk, Balkh, Merv, Nishapur, Herat, Ghazni. The glorious cities of Central Asia toppled like dominoes before fierce horsemen who burst from the Mongolian steppe in the 13th century. According to one survivor of a Mongol raid, they came, they sapped, they burnt, they slew, they plundered, and they departed. The leader of this ruthless horde was called Genghis Khan, or strong ruler. But was Genghis Khan only a merciless killer and looter? The answer, say modern historians, is yes and no. There is no question that the Mongols blazed a trail of destruction. Some historians think that Genghis Khan stifled development in parts of Asia for centuries. Other scholars point out that Genghis was simply a major player in one of the most war-torn centuries in history. While crusaders attacked in the Holy Land and dynasties fought one another in China, Central Asia suffered a number of wars even before Genghis invaded. Whatever opinions historians may hold, present-day Mongolians regard Genghis Khan as a national hero. After more than 6 decades of Soviet domination, during which Mongolia's own history was suppressed to destroy any trace of national pride, Mongolians have reclaimed Genghis Khan as the father of their country. In the capital, Ulaanbaatar, the former Lenin Avenue is now Genghis Khan Avenue, and Genghis's face is stamped on the currency. The boy who would grow up to be the Great Khan was born in the 1160s, some 200 miles, or 321.8 kilometers northeast of Ulaanbaatar, near the Yunnan River. It is said that the baby, named Temujin, or blacksmith, was born with a clot of blood in his hand, a sign of good fortune. Later, his shaman, a spiritual leader, told Temujin that the supreme Mongol deity had ordained him to be master of the world. At this time, the Mongolian population included some 30 nomadic groups that had long vied with one another for power. When Temujin was 9, Tatars poisoned his father, a minor chieftain. To help the family survive, Temujin and his brothers caught fish and snared small animals called marmots. Like other Mongol children, Temujin grew up on horseback, probably learning to ride at age 4 or 5. In his youth, Temujin began to demonstrate the leadership that would make him famous. He made allies with other leaders, one of whom was Togril, a leader of the Karayats. When the Merkit group kidnapped Temujin's young wife, Borte, in a raid, Togril and other friends helped Temujin rescue her. Later, through conquest or bestowal of gifts, Temujin steadily built a confederation of groups. He did not include the Tatars, who had killed his father. When he defeated them, he left only the smallest males alive and enslaved the women and children. This act of vengeance effectively erased the Tatars from the face of the earth. One of the ironies of history is that Europeans for centuries used a variation of the name Tatars to refer to the Mongols. Eventually, some of Temujin's former friends began to oppose his growing power, but he crushed them. When he was about 40, the Mongols named him Genghis Khan. Some historians suggest Genghis did not consciously set out to conquer the world. He acted because he needed to feed his people and supply them with horses, although he may at times have been out for revenge. Whatever the Mongol leader's motivation, however, warfare was an old tradition among these nomads, and soon Genghis's army was on the move. According to modern researchers, his troops never numbered more than 110,000, but they were molded into a disciplined force. Genghis was a canny judge of men who had survived power struggles. To prevent other leaders from gaining too much influence, Genghis gave command only to those who had proven themselves in campaigns. Genghis's army moved against 2 kingdoms in quick succession. His first campaign outside Mongolia was in 1209 against Zhizha. Zhizha was a kingdom in northern China that controlled oases along the Silk Road and exacted heavy taxes from Mongol caravans. To reach Ninjia, the capital, now the Chinese city of Yinchuan, Genghis's army had to cross the Gobi, a harsh desert that had discouraged invasions. Crossing was relatively easy for Mongol nomads, however, who could survive on mare's milk and blood drawn from a cut in a horse's hide. After a defeat by Genghis's forces, the emperor of Zhizha opted for peace in 1210, offering tribute and giving Genghis one of his daughters to marry. This pattern was repeated with the vastly richer kingdom east of Jingzha, ruled by the Qin dynasty, which had controlled northern China for more than a century. With much of the 600,000-man Jin army bogged down in a war with the south, Genghis's 70,000 troops slaughtered the remnant force blocking their way into northern China. Chinese texts say disheartened Jin troops changed sides and swore allegiance to the invader. When the Mongols surrounded the Jin capital of Zhengzhou, present-day Beijing, in 1214, the emperor offered gold, silver, and other tribute, including one of his daughters, if Genghis would withdraw his troops. Returning to Mongolia, as he would after each campaign, Genghis began to build a capital at Karakorum. Not one to waste talented artisans, he marched some 30,000 of them back from Zhizha to put them to work raising his citadel. Genghis also borrowed from other cultures to develop Mongol society. He used a scholar in China to advise him on building a government, and recruited Uyghurs, his advanced Turkic neighbors, as accountants and scribes. Soon a school was turning out Mongol tax collectors and record keepers. In 1218, Genghis sent one of his trusted generals, Jebe, to preempt a possible attack by the Prince of Karakatai at Mongolia's western border. The mostly Muslim people rejoiced to be freed of their ruler, who had forbidden them to practice their religion and had crucified a religious leader. Genghis took Karakatai into his protection. With success in that quarter, Genghis's territory now touched that of the wealthy Khwarezm Empire, ruled by Shah Muhammad in Samarkand. Genghis attempted to establish friendly trade relations with the Shah, but the Khwarezm would not cooperate. A caravan of 450 Mongol merchants were murdered by the governor of one of Khwarezm's outlying regions. When Genghis sent an ambassador to the Shah to demand the governor be handed over, the Shah had the ambassador killed and his head sent back to Genghis. Thus, Genghis aimed to punish his enemies, although the possibility of enormous plunder was surely an added incentive for his campaign. Although the Shah's army was much larger than that of the Mongols, he proved a weak adversary. When Genghis appeared outside Samarkand, the Shah fled. City nobles opened the gates and begged for mercy, but some of the Shah's soldiers refused to surrender. About 1,000 took refuge in the mosque, hoping for Allah's protection, but flaming Mongol arrows rained on the building. When archaeologists excavated the site centuries later, they found burned bones. More destruction was to come. In Bukhara, Genghis rode his horse into the courtyard of the Friday Mosque, ordered the nobles to bring him their riches, then turned his troops loose to pillage, rape, and burn the city to the ground. Next came the Silk Road cities of Urganshk and Merv. By one account, a Muslim holy man and his helpers spent 13 days in Merv counting corpses, tallying 1.3 million in all, taking into account only those that were plain to see. Although Muslim accounts of Mongol butchery also report enormous numbers, historians doubt these cities had such large populations. Some cities might have been decimated to frighten others. While Genghis pursued Muhammad's son Jalal, who had escaped, he sent his generals Jebe and Subadai after the Shah. The pair chased Muhammad to the Caspian Sea, where the exhausted Shah died. Having now entered new territory, the two generals took 20,000 troops on a reconnaissance of Europe. Living off the land over the next 3 years and vanquishing every opposing army, they rode 8,000 miles or 12,872 kilometers, circling the Caspian in one of the greatest cavalry exploits of all time. Upon rejoining Genghis in the Central Asian steppe, the warriors headed for home. Genghis had a last score to settle. Just before the campaign against the Khwarezm Empire, the Zhizha had insulted him, and they had since been trying to revolt. In 1226, he decided it was time to teach them a lesson. As fate would have it, the lesson would be taught by someone else. One account says that Genghis had an accident and fell when his horse shied, another that he was ill, perhaps with typhus. In any case, the great Khan delivered his final orders from his deathbed, the extermination of the Zhizha people. His army is said to have killed mothers and fathers down to the offspring of their offspring. Finally, in August 1227, Genghis Khan died. His body is supposed to be buried near a mountain called Burkhan Khaldun. It is said that 1,000 horsemen trampled the site, so the grave could not be found. Its location is still a mystery.